like to begin our session with a prayer that comes from Elmer Witt's book on Help It All Make Sense, Lord, which is really for teenagers, but which really speaks to me too, and I think to you as well. Well, Lord, my Lord, fill me with that Christian love that looks for a way of being constructive, love that is not possessive, that does not cherish inflated ideas of its own importance, that has good manners, is not touchy, does not compile statistics of evil, and does not gloat over wickedness of others. O Lord, my Lord, teach me that Christian love that is glad when truth prevails, that knows no limit to endurance, has no end to its trust, has no fading of its hope, that can outlast anything. O Lord, my Lord, give me the faith that produces love like this. Through Jesus Christ, amen. I think some of the things that this prayer says are ones that I would like to underscore, and we certainly have as we went around here in Words of Wisdom, that can help make our roles as liberated parents and liberated children valuable, enriching, such as endurance, such as trust, such as hope, the whole area of love, of being constructive rather than destructive. I'm sure there's no one in any relationship that really begins, or at least there are very few times, that anyone begins with intentions of being destructive. I really feel that most often we begin with fairly good intentions, and somewhere along the way, for whatever the reason, things begin to slip or slide. Something happens and some button gets pushed and our feelings produce anger or whatever. Or we lack a sense of trust or endurance or patience in our anticipation, what we're in the process of doing switches from being constructive to being destructive. Hurtful rather than helpful. Harmful rather than healing. Whether it's our own feelings of importance or non-importance come into this, how we look at the importance or non-importance of our own children, whatever age they have. Sometimes our good manners become an end in itself rather than the whole being of the person. And we look at statistics and say that these are the kinds of things that are happening, and we don't want them to happen with our children, so we've got to tighten up and we've got to strangle in the process so that the statistic does not become a true one. Does not gloat over wickedness of others. That speaks for itself. How do we look at what is happening in a sense of, it's not happening to me, therefore, filling the spaces. Okay. Help it all make sense, Lord. I think it's a constant prayer that we probably, in the very first word, the help is a very important, however we happen to say it. And perhaps if we as parents said it a little bit more often, we might find that we have a little bit more help available. I often feel that areas, you name it, if you're a bridge player, I'm not. If you're a tennis player, if you play golf, neither which I do really. I played my first game of tennis a couple of weeks ago and 20 years. it was fun, but I usually find something else that I enjoy with my time instead. But it seems as if people are much more ready and more receptive to participate in a tennis clinic or a bridge class or a golf clinic than a parents class. And the area that I really am most interested in working in is in the area of parent education, and yet there are really very few possibilities. And if there are possibilities, they're all volunteer possibilities. There's nothing that can help the family, or there are very few possibilities for helping the family budget in this area. And yet it's one of the very most important. What area, what profession, what area of work is there any possibility in, except parenting, which is a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job, really, that does not take training? Engineer, how would you like to have a doctor operate on you who just decided, I'm going to be a doctor, and hung out a shingle, or decided to start working on the leg that's broken? I'm not sure I would feel very comfortable, and I'm not sure you would either. If you're a clerk in a store, have you looked at cash registers lately? They boggle my mind. They're certainly very different from the old general kind of thing that most people could understand, but there's a technique to that, and there's a skill to that, and there's a training to that. No businessman is going to allow somebody behind one of these very expensive cash registers, or even the old inexpensive, if you can find one anymore, type that isn't going to know something about money and how you deal with it and how you ring up prices and so forth. That takes some kind of training, whether it's even a couple of hours. It's some beginning. Parenting is one of those professions that is a non-profession. It's the one that's most time-consuming, and yet it takes the least amount of time and preparation for it. If you are mature enough to procreate, it doesn't matter. You can have children, you can have them by the dozens. And if you are not very capable in caring for your children, and your child is taken away from you, most judges will return them to you, because home is where a child, with a mother particularly, is where a child belongs. Can be a child abusing mother, it can be a dope addictive mother, but that's where the child will generally end up back, whether it's going to be helpful or harmful to the child. It really takes almost an act of God or extreme cruelty to really get a child removed from a home. And then where do you move them to? There are very few options, really. So we first of all, is sensitizing to what is the role of a parent. That it does take responsibility, it's time consuming, it takes patience, it takes some knowledge. What can you expect? What might you expect at different ages? What might you do to help these things develop at whatever ages they are? Well, that's more the field of Doris than it is of mine, and she's done some great sessions through Monday, Tuesday, Thursdays, and Fridays that you might still be able to pick up on what to expect and what to fill in at these particular ages, specifically for the young child. Since we have an hour or less to look at what is our role as parents and how does this, what do we mean by a liberated parent or a liberated child? I'm really, in a sense, a fairly conservative one in many ways, a traditional one, and yet I think I'm a fairly liberated one. I have some very strong convictions, and I have strong soapboxes, those of you who have been in any of my other sessions. And that in the non-traditional sense, I'm very much against violence. And I think most of you would probably be very much against violence too, but yet we often put spanking, for instance, outside of that realm of violence. And yet I think that's the kind of violence that might lead in many respects, not all the time certainly, to further violence. And if we teach our children that violence is one way of getting them to behave, they probably don't understand it as behaving. It becomes translated to them as violence is one thing that you can get away with as long as you're bigger than the other person. And that's what parents are often saying when they deal with a smaller child. They certainly are bigger. What is our major goal as parents? What does it mean as a liberated parent, and what does this mean for liberated children? What do we look at as our role, as our goal? What are our values? What are our expectations? Well, we need a long while to work on this, and I hope this might be our kind of a beginning of something that you can continue as you discuss with your spouses, what you discuss with the rest of your family, children as well. How will children learn about the role of parents unless we as parents help them to think and look and listen and learn and deal and act on it? It's not just a silent kind of thing, watch my role model and therefore do as I do or don't do as I do. But what do we say along with our actions? Sometimes our actions speak louder than the words we might want to speak. Sometimes our actions need some words to help them to be understood. Modeling is a very important teacher, and sometimes we model things that we would be surprised to find out that that's indeed what we have modeled. Sometimes we might be very pleased. What do we look at? What does it profit us if we have neat, polite, charming children who can watch others suffer and not be moved to action? What have we accomplished if we have reared a child who is brilliant but who uses that intellect to manipulate, and in that manipulation maybe destroy others? Manipulation to me is a very negative word. It goes along with spanking. It goes along with violence. Or might our larger goal be to raise humans to become humane, to be Christians in the fullest sense? And if this is one of our goals, we might have many others. Let's deal with these as a beginning. What methods do we use to accomplish this? If we use methods that are insults, attacks, threats, whippings, then we can be very sure that we have also taught the other to insult, to attack, to threaten, and to comply when threatened, and maybe even beat up others. If on the other hand we use methods that are humane, that are kind, considerate, forgiving, then we've taught something more important than a series of isolated virtues, such as openness or gentleness or honesty. Perhaps we've shown someone how to be a person, a human being who can conduct one's own life with dignity, humaneness, compassion, hope, caring, and forgiveness. Well, what does that say to us? Our actions are important. Our words are important as we describe what are the kinds of things we're doing. Liberated parents, liberated children. How are we to help our children develop that inner self, not just be motivated by what the hearers commands, demands from the outside, rules, to live under the law only without the gospel as well, that relies on somebody else to tell them constantly what is expected of them and what is it for them to do. Kind of person that can be moved very easily by peer group pressure rather than what is for the greatest benefit, what is my role, what is my response as a Christian in this particular situation. If I can see you as a person who is capable of helping, caring, and loving, is said, it tells someone something more than that, that in time of trouble, we don't blame. In time of trouble, we focus on solutions from alternative choices. In time of trouble, we lend each other a helping ear and hand. We can listen. Perhaps that's the greatest thing that we can contribute in certain times of trouble. And other times, it might take more than just the ear of listening. It may need also the hand of helping. How do we say this? What is it about the language that we use that can aid in the development of human beings, of humane Christian beings? Well, our language does not evaluate. We have the command not to judge one another. It avoids expressions which do judge one's character or ability or labels. How many of you have grown up with certain labels, names, that you have felt to be a handicap? I was the youngest of four children. My oldest brother was 10 years older. We were nicely spaced, but I have lived for 40-some years as being the baby of the family, and I feel that that has been very handicapping. And I feel embarrassed, and I realize that I should by this time be very used to it, that my mother, at this time in my life, still introduces me as the baby of the family. And I, you know, inside I just groan and I cringe and I should be able to say to myself, okay, that's the way my mother is always going to introduce me, and I don't need to let it bother me. And sometimes I can get to that strength and say, it's not going to bother me. And sometimes I just close my eyes and try to close my ears. But that's not the worst kind of label that somebody could put on.
I rather enjoyed it. I was a baby too. I enjoyed being a baby.
I guess I must have, I don't know why I put it negatively. But I did, and I sort of have that kind of feeling. Others may not have had that same experience. But other labels, you know, were you called slowpoke? Were you called the brain, and you felt you always had to live up to certain things? Were anyone ever called stupid? I just shudder for the number of kids that are labeled stupid by people. Whether they're parents, whether they're friends, whether they're own peers, or whether they're by teachers. Oh.
Stinker.
Stinker.
I've heard that so many times.
And sometimes it's done playfully as they shake the head, you little stinker, and sometimes I'm sure it's given them, you little stinker, get out of here. You know, and okay, how do you differentiate between the one and the other?
It's funny, it really is. Just depending on context, stinker for us is a loving term with our child. You know, even stinker. It's not a, you know.
Oh, and there's even little sweatshirts, little infant garments that have "you little stinker" written across the diaper or the panties or something like this.
We probably just use that as stinker bodies and
okay.
They would tell me that's a good intonation.
Okay, so we're saying that there's our communication has to.
Don't write it, say it.
Okay, that may also make us think, have we ever used that term negatively? And then does that cause confusion for the child?
Yeah, you could offhand say, well, he's been such a stinker today. You know.
And the child hears it? And says, what does that name really mean?
And then the next time you use it in a loving way, he'll wonder, is it a loving way?
Okay,
and
so
you
if you
get the same effect just by saying their full name, and they think their middle name is something awful.
A lot of kids, or a lot of adults I know, say, I knew when my mother said Frances Louise,
our oldest one,
that was really.
The next littler one, she called her by her own middle name. Figured that meant naughty.
Otherwise, it never included the whole name. Words of wisdom. Look and think about the names you call your children, or your spouse, or your friends. A lot of these things, you know, are more broad, can be put into broader use than just parent-child, child-parent communication. As a friend has said, made me aware of the whole issue of when do you touch your child? Is it when you're really angry? Is the touch when you really shake him by the shoulders, or you stop him from doing something, or you set him down in a chair, whatever, short of really violence? And how is that distinguished from when you do put your arm around your child? Or you take the child by the hand, or you pat him on the shoulder, or you ruffle the hair, or whatever you do at whatever particular age that you're comfortable with. How can the child distinguish clearly between one, the positive and the negative? And we have some friends who have said that that was a shocking awareness to them, and they have had conversations with the children about this, that in their household the physical contact will be positive, and if they're really angry, that's when it's going to be away, and they're not going to touch them. I have some puzzling feelings about that. I haven't really finalized in my own mind that there are times that you may have to touch a child in order to continue communication. And that it may not be a real rough kind of thing, but sometimes when you're really angry, to have a physical contact with the other person, whether it's your spouse or your child, can sometimes help to drain off the negative element that, okay, let's really try to work on this. And I'm not doing it just to hold you back, but you can tell the difference in the feeling. Is it a really a tightened, angry, upset kind of control feeling? Or is it a feeling that's loving and says, let's work this out? And that's something to think about. What does our touch say? Touch communicates. It communicates very strongly. And think about how you communicate with your hands as well as your mouth. Okay. Use words that describe is a very helpful way to use language. Describe what you see. that table's spotless. Rather than, oh, what a good girl you are. Or what a good boy you are. What a good girl you are for dusting off the smoke screen or the chimney. That really is, that earned you a gold star.
to turn that back on you, I'll say, you're so nice to compliment.
I really didn't want to say that, but it was a good...
I know, it was an example, no. But it would have been better to have said that it looks a lot better dusted.
It does look... We had some work going on here before many of you came in that needed to be done. Use words that tell how you feel. I'm glad there are people who can find things to do even without being told. And sometimes we just wait, say, well, certainly that's somebody else's job, and I don't want to take somebody else's job away from them, so I'll sit back and say, why doesn't somebody get around and dust that shield? Why doesn't? Somebody should know better. We get caught up in our shoulds. Words which evaluate hinder a person and they build walls. Think about the boxes that are built up. Sometimes you feel concerned about, should I or shouldn't I? Is this possible or impossible? What kind of walls do we build up around ourselves? Labels sometimes build walls. More often build walls than not. Words that describe can help set one free because it avoids blame. And it puts the emphasis where it belongs, on what needs to be done, rather than causing a person to use one's energy to defend oneself. You sloppy pig. I'm not a sloppy pig, and don't you go calling me a pig. You're a pig. So what happens? You really start throwing, and it goes away from the issue that you want to deal with, that something needs to be cleaned up. And attacks personalities, takes energy that could be used constructively, and it aims it destructively at the other person, because I'm not going to let anybody call me a name like that. I'm going to get back at them, and I'm going to set them straight, and I'm going to do them one better. So we snowball, and we completely forget the issue that's at hand. Something needs to be cleaned. Something needs to be picked up. So use words that describe what needs to be done, what you feel, what you see that you do not like. How about the ability to turn a threat into a choice? I think that's one that parents need to learn very early, maybe in their own relationship with each other before they become parents. And as I said the other day, I'm in another one of my soapboxes, I have quite a few, is looking at families, and that when couples say, we've decided to start our family. I want to correct them and say, if you haven't already become a family as a husband and wife, as mates, then don't add children into the non-family. Children do not a family make. That you can be a family if you live all your life with a spouse. You can be family if you live all your life as a single person, I firmly believe. Some people might argue with me on that, and I'll respect their opinion. But I feel that children are not necessary for a family. They certainly add a particular dimension to a family. It may be very interesting. It may be very time-consuming. It may be however you want to describe it. Children are part of a family, but a family is also a male and female who live together. Or a female or a male who lives by themselves. So we were working on a conference on the family this past spring, and we wanted to try to depict on a poster something visual. What comes to your mind when you think about a family that you can put down visually or in symbols? And what are your suggestions? Maybe it would give us an idea of what we should have put on there instead.
What a family does to
you. What a family is. Visually, what do you see as a family? If you were to draw a family, what would you draw?
Well, probably the thing, when you first said it, that comes to my mind is just, you know, sitting around the dinner table so often.
That's when you most often see a family, is when they get together to eat a meal. Okay, and what is it composed of?
The family? Mm-hmm. Well, either two people or the whole, you know, there's children with everybody there. Grandparents, you know, it can be extended.
Okay, it could include a variety of others. When we asked somebody to draw the poster for us, the first thing that came out and the first three things that came out were a man, a woman, and two kids. Well, it's fine if you want to emphasize ZPG for zero population growth, that you stick with two children and no more. But in our society today, families aren't mother, father, and two children. There's sometimes mother and five children, or mother or husband and wife and no children, or father and two children, or one. There's a or grandmother or aunt Tilly or Uncle John or somebody. Those are rare, but they're possible. So we really have had difficulty in visualizing a family, and we have sometimes difficulty in living with families.
What did
we ended up with a man, a woman, and an infant. Not because that's really what we wanted, but because we really got all screwed up on our time schedule, and the graphics person who was doing this for us procrastinated, and we were long past the deadline of getting it into the printers. You know, it wasn't what we wanted. We ended up going ahead with it because it was the only thing we had.
Have you thought of something that would be better?
No, we really
haven't.
The first
picture when you said that was hands.
Hands?
Joined. Ah. Well, hands joined, it could be a couple. Because a family, you know, two hands joined or sickness.
I thought of it in a circle.
Yeah, I didn't even think of it in a circle. I thought of in a line, like hands walking. And just, you know, how you see a couple or a family, be it a father, mother, and a child between them. You see the hands joined.
Good idea. I think that would be an improvement over what we did. Anything would have been an improvement over what we did. What is it about liberated parents and liberated children, if we can use those titles again, that can help us to know when not to help? To help us to know when we lead and when we follow, when we lead, when we sit back. At the various stages. That's when it's important to know what happens at various stages. The past 2 years, we've had an interesting family group in our congregation, and it was composed of a father who was in his early 30s and his two young daughters who were kindergarten and first grade. The mother was off somewhere else. The family had separated. The mother had custody of the children at first, and after a month came to her husband, her ex-husband, and said, "I really don't want them. I can't live with these two children." And he was at a point where he really missed them. He was a teacher, and it was the beginning of summer, so he had the whole summer together with them to get settled, which was very fortunate, he felt. But he had had them since they were age 2 and 3, his total responsibility. He was a graduate student. And it was very interesting. He said, "You don't find things written for the single father. That's a new area yet. Everyone thinks, I'm not capable of dealing. What am I going to do the first time I have a child homesick with a contagious disease? which happened with chicken pox this past year. And he said, now I really feel I've been initiated. And I managed. But we've often felt that the father was a second class, the male was a second class human being when it came dealing with children. And I think that's a great new liberated feeling. Not that I would promote the fathers be single parents with their children and go off and do it on their own. I think children do need two parents. They need two adults, somebody at least to help trade off and have patience when the other one has gone out of it, to get difference of opinions, to talk about, to deal together, to have that extra amount of love and sharing and comforting to give. But I think it's great to see the number of young fathers that we see now really caring and having the ability
I've
and the concern.
I've noticed a big increase in fathers attending my sessions this year.
Great.
So many more fathers than ever have in previous summers. Which I think
marvelous.
Shows that they are aware of their opportunity to nurture too.
That nurturing is just not a female characteristic. We've long too often held that myth, and that's what it is. Sometimes, and we know of several other situations in our neighborhood where when families have separated, these were with older children, the children stayed with the father because all through their growing up life, it was the father who did the special things with them. The mother was very verbal in saying, I just don't like children. And feeling very guilty about it. Or because someone was ill and the mother died and the father cares for the children and with great concern and great abilities. So we need to really remember that parents can include M-O-T-H-E-R and F-A-T-H-E-R. Parent is not spelled M-O-T-H-E-R. How do we know when to help, when not to help, when to say, let's give it a try, when to say, what would you like to try, what can you do, how can we share responsibilities, to know when not to help is a gift, I think. And it's one that we need to really work on. And we often forget it when we come to the teenage years. I'm concerned also by the number of mothers and fathers who are saying, well, my children are now 9, 11, and 13. They don't need me anymore. And I think of my own children who may have been that age at that time, who are now 12 and a half and 15 and a half, saying, well, that's true. There are many areas in which they don't need me. But there are times I can feel fairly self-sufficient, but I feel that to have my family, a home, as Robert Frost saying, a home is where when you go there, they have to take you in. To know there's always a place that you can go back to. There's always a place that you can to look to for strength and for comfort at whatever the age happens to be, at age 40 or at age 15. That there's a kind of strengthening and a kind of refreshment and re-nurturing that you get back in the family. And that there may be things that the teenager years can be very self-sufficient in, but they're certainly not yet out on their own. And that's a myth that I think is beginning to get a good amount of viability, that once your kids become the teenage years, they really don't need you anymore. And that maybe parents need their teenage children more than the teenagers need them. Well, it may be a myth on both sides. Maybe there are some teenagers who'd like to say, I really don't need my parents. I can do it on my own, and I can go off, and I can travel. I can find myself. I can't find myself within my family. I've got to go off on my own to find myself, without realizing that you only grow within your, you only can become in contact with other people, that becoming oneself is an ongoing process that's never ending. You don't go off on a retreat, or you don't go out traveling for 6 months to find oneself, because you never really do in its total sense. It's a continuing process that goes on. And you find yourself in one situation that finds yourself responding differently in another situation. It's not a closed end door, that you can find a door with a lock and a key, and when you get to that point, you walk beyond it, turn around, close the door, and latch it and throw the key away. Because it's always a movement back and forth, in and out, both adults and for children too, whatever their age. It's an ongoing process. It's done in relationships to people. It's done within the situation. Environment has a great importance in this area, that one's life, one's response is in relationship to and because of, not just that period. So in knowing where to stop, when to help and when not to help, I think as we get into the older years, it's a good thing to discuss this with children. One of the things we find in our household is how to change after so many years of talking about our young daughters or our young kids. And when they get into the stage of junior high and senior high, it's sort of our little. That's another kind of adjective that has, it's okay at certain points, but then even the 3 and 4 year olds don't want to be called little anymore. I'm a big boy. It's a kind of, it's taken as a kind of put down. How do we look at our labels? How do we look at our language? How do we begin to look at what happens within our family as it concerns the whole family? Part of knowing when and when not to help depends upon how we can communicate within the family. And I'm very much a student of Rudolf Dreiker's in family councils to discuss within the family what are our rules, what are our goals, how do we, so that there's communication in, there's sharing in the development of them, so that we each can participate, and therefore if we're participating in setting down certain rules and recommendations, there's something that I had a hand in and I will be more responsible and responsive to them. When things are put on you, when the law is just set down, you know, look at what happens with the new speed limit on the highway. It's 55. But if you go along the most highways, interstates at 55, you don't see anything but cars passing you. These are laws and rules that are put down. It makes some sense. Accidents have gone down. Gas consumption is better when you're going slower. But that's, we have all this knowledge of how much better it is. But yeah, we didn't set the rules. That's somebody else, something somebody else is telling us, so we can always bend them a little bit. How do we become a part of this? One other aspect in the whole area of parents and children is looking at praise when good isn't good enough. Sometimes our labels become kind of judgments. Good report card, bad, which means then there is a bad report card. Good boy, which means I can also be a bad boy. So we come back to how can we describe then what we see, what we feel. How do we help each one develop a positive and realistic self-image? Our feelings are formed bit by bit as we go along. How do we help each one, whether it's adults in the household and the youngsters in the household, develop that kind of positive self-image, positive concept that says, I can, rather than I can't. And I think that's very difficult, particularly for adults. If we haven't developed one ourselves, it's a struggle to help not only us catch up, but to help our children to develop that positive sense. One of my other soapboxes that I have is with a label that says, labeling can be disabling. Or the little button that says, label jars, not people. And I realize our time has gone very quickly, and we have about 5 or 10 minutes for some open questions as we deal with our family.
I'm learning, I've only got one child, and speaking, this is going back to your touching, negative touching and whatnot. My main problem and something I'm trying to work out is, and it tied in with your classes and mine too, and we didn't get at that, but you know, how do you deal with open defiance when it's over and over again, and how do you finally end it without violence? Is what, you know, my child is 3, and it's not so much now as like 2-ish, you know, when they're just at a...
The terrible 2.
Negative.
Very negative, and you know, you say, don't pound on the table with that hammer, and then he smiles and does it. And so you can take the hammer away, and he can do something else, or where it's just openly, I'm gonna get you.
Who
you
is
know,
it?
How do you, I just don't know how to deal with that in terms of ending it non-violent.
Who is it that said children never hear the first part of any message you give them, so if you say, don't do that, all they hear you say is, do that! Mm-hmm. And they've got to live up to your commands. It's a kind of invitation to see what's the kind of study of wills, in a sense. What are other ways? Don't do that. What are other ways we can deal with? Turn a threat into a choice. It's one of the things Haim Gnat has emphasized very strongly in Liberated Parents, Liberated Children. Hammers are for pounding nails. Is there a board with some nails in where it can be done?
Yeah. Maybe that's a bad example because there are other. But it's more an attitude.
Don't bite.
More an attitude of maybe even if you haven't said it, but maybe it almost is preset with something I do, you know. But sort of more an attitude on their part.
They are seeking autonomy at that age, and it's so strong. I mean, it's such a natural drive to do what they want to do. And if you look at it, I think, as a natural drive, it won't drive you so crazy. Because you say, you know, all 2s and 3s go through this stage. Dealing with it at the time, I think, is, as you said, substitute something else. Or if you see him take the hammer, then suggest another activity. There was one little boy I had in nursery school, and we always he always clued us in when he was going to become destructive. His fists would be clenched and he'd go like this. And I always told my student teachers, now watch him. If you see him do this, go take his hand and get him busy with something else, because he's on the destruction path. Mm-hmm. And our own children, I think, give us clues. But in different ways.
Or that we haven't learned to read very well.
Yeah.
That you need to learn to read actions.
Yes.
I would like to speak up in favor of spanking, and I'll get on another soapbox.
Okay.
Because there are ways to do it and ways not to do it. But I would argue with anybody that says sending them off to their room is better because it's not violent, because to me that's rejection. And if you spank a child, you're expressing your disapproval. They know they've made you mad, and sometimes this is helpful for them to realize. And the whole situation is taken care of. It's all done with.
And you wipe their slate clean, and they don't have to feel any sense of guilt or remorse or determination to try better the next time, because they've already paid for it.
And sometimes it's worse to not punish a child because they really know they deserve it.
And maybe that can help build their inner sense of, I really know I shouldn't do this, but if I know I'm going to get spanked, I can go ahead and do it because that wipes it clean. It's like saying, okay, you've served your 2 years in prison. Yeah, you served your 2 years in prison. Now, since I paid for that one, I can go out and do it again. Don't get caught.
We've raised 4 kids that way, and this has never happened, and they've never started hitting someone else as a punishment. So I think there are ways to do it. I think it's an option that, you know, I'd like to have been able to do it without doing that. Mm-hmm. But I always got to the point where I found that I couldn't. I think the thing that bothers my husband and I so much is him getting the attitude that he's could always win, or that he's good in his way.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, and
read, you can have a family where everybody wins. It's the Christian approach to parent effectiveness training. Christian perspectives. I firmly believe that families can exist where everybody wins, and it doesn't have to be the parent walked over by the child or the child chained up by the parent. And I realize that the whole issue of spanking goes very, 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 very deep. And I recall one adult student that I had, and I say adult, who was finishing her degree in home economics. Well, no, as a matter of fact, she was teaching home economics, and she was doing some graduate work. And she took my course in working with parents. And each time I began the issue, and she had two children who were age 3 and 6. And each time we got into an issue of dealing with what are the options? And I feel very strongly that one need not be limited in dealing with misbehavior to the two options of either name-calling or spanking. There's a whole world out there that we haven't quite yet discovered, and I've only started to touch on it, I'm sure. But I grew up where spanking was the means by which we were dealt with. But I also grew up with great fears. I was the youngest of four. As I said before, I can recall my older brothers, who were the two oldest in the family, who really got whipped with a belt. And cried at those times. And I'm sure I must have been a goody little two-shoes, because I was scared to death that that was going to happen to me. And I think I lived in terror of my parents because of this.
She touched on the power play thing, and you mentioned Dreikers. Dreikers deals with that. I don't go along with Dreikers all the way. Because
the
I
one
think
she
he,
just talked
yeah,
about.
Yeah, he's,
well,
in,
no,
in the
that's America. Something else.
No, that's another one.
Yeah.
Because
children the challenge.
Is there, I see a danger in some of his manipulations of the child, where the parent manipulates the child. But he has some awfully good suggestions to overcome this business of power play.
Yeah. The whole dealing with logical and natural consequences. Okay, if something has been destroyed or messed, the person doesn't just get a spanking while mother goes and cleans up the mess. Part of it is to be responsible for your actions. You clean it up, you try to replace, you try to redo. That says a lot more to the child and gives them a lot more responsibility than just having the slate wiped clean by spanking.
What happens if he refuses to clean it up? That's
okay.
Right. You know that the song. It sounds so good, but what happens when they say no?
Okay. Maybe it's saying you clean up, and you stand over. Well, I'm not sure. I want to have somebody big stand over me and say you do it or else. I'd prefer spanking than two, because it's simpler and it's easier. But to say this has happened, in the same. You may be very upset. I'm upset about this. This has happened. We'll clean it up. And when you're beginning with a two-year-old, you're not going to expect a two-year-old to be able to do the same kind of things that you as a 20-some-year-old can do and know how to do. So that maybe at the beginning, as you're in this beginning stage, to say, we'll clean this up. This is how we're going to do it. And I think often we cut ourselves off at the pass by saying, they're not going to do it, and what'll I do if they refuse? Maybe it waits there for a while until it's cleaned up. And maybe the child is limited from doing something else until it's cleaned up. And I can remember a real power play that I had with our first child, we have two, when she was about 4 or so, and she did something rather obnoxious to a student who was visiting in our house. And we said, Anna, you say you're sorry. Well, we went on and realized for 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes that we were not, no one at that point. And as I look back at it, I thought, I wouldn't, under threat of death, have said I'm sorry when somebody was going to be so determined that I was going to say it. Ida LaShawn says that sometimes our children can learn the I'm sorry and the thank yous and the gee, that's nice much better by hearing mom and dad say it. So Aunt Tilly gives us a lollipop instead of saying, now, Susan, you tell Aunt Tilly how nice she is for having given you a lollipop, to be able to say instead, Aunt Tilly, that was very thoughtful of you to give Susan a lollipop. I'm sure she will enjoy it. And that allows the child to be freer to say, yeah, I will enjoy it. I will thank you. Thank you, Aunt Tilly. And that helps the child to develop this kind of inner self. Somebody has given me something. My feeling is I will enjoy it. But if Aunt Tilly gives them an orange, and they absolutely hate oranges, no way are you going to get that child to say, thank you, Aunt Tilly, for the nice orange. I'm going to enjoy it. Maybe mother is just going to have to say, thank you for bringing something. We'll put it here and he can have it later so that the child doesn't have to admit in a situation like that, I hate oranges. We're not saying you're bad for giving this or that's wrong, which depending upon how the person is, you might be able to say, that's thoughtful of you to bring the orange. I'm sorry that this is one thing he doesn't like yet or something if it's a young child. How do we help our children to accept things gracefully and to learn things gracefully unless we share it along with them? Sometimes if we didn't know that they're going to be terrible twos and terrible threes, they might act differently. If we can assume that they're going to be willing, children will be willing. If we assume they're going to be obstinate, and they are, it proves that they're going to be, and what am I going to do? And you get uptight, and you get even more concerned and worried, and you've lost it, and they've won. It's, how can we assume that they already are what we hope for them to become? You had a question.
I was just going to say, I think with the first child, you know, they're at 2 years old or 3 years old, and you think, gee, if I don't stop this bad habit right now, they're going to turn into a terrible kid. And after having, I know our first child, we expected her to be perfect. She's not going to go somewhere and count on somebody's furniture. And we're quite sure about it. But as time has gone on now with our third one, I know he's going to stop pulling the plugs and the time to move off the table. So I'm not, you know, quick to discipline, and I'll try to get his interest in something.
Okay.
But I think you really do that first child.
First,
I think there's so much a projection of a 3-year-old into an adult. But what he does at 3, I was sure that my son was going to be a masochist and a sadist, and you know, the way he treated a cat, and you know that. You know, I think that there's such a tendency to project. This is my miniature adult right here.
I just realized I started a story and I got caught in the middle of it. The woman who had this. Two children, who was the home ec teacher, would always make a statement in rebuttal about spanking and saying, but I was spanked, and look, you know, look how well I grew up. And you know there's not going to be anyone who will ever say, hey, have you really thought about how well you've grown up? I mean, or there may be a tactful way, but I've not learned it, I've not figured it out. So you just don't say anything and it's accepted. And she would say, I spank my children, and they know right well where they belong and what it is, and I spank them, and my 6-year-old goes and pinches and bites and tears up things in my 3-year-old, and I spank him, and he goes right back to do it. And I didn't say anything. We ended up going into a break, and then, you know, I guess, and came back to class, went on to something else. Another day, she started saying some of these same things, and look how well I grew up, and my kids are doing this, and they're going to learn, and they learn how to manage. Then she'd come back, but now my 6-year-old does this to the 3-year-old. And finally she began to hear, and I began to listen. This still happens. You're saying that even after you spank the child will go back. I could say, is it working? I didn't at this particular point until she finally said, I guess maybe it really isn't working. And could answer herself that maybe I'm going to have to, and she decided maybe there were some other alternatives that she could use other than spanking. And there are times I've shaken my daughters and I felt very guilty about it. There are times that I've spanked my daughters and I have felt very guilty about it. There are times that I've done this and when I've been out of control myself and I've had to go to my children and say, I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking very well and I was not feeling very well and I have to apologize for doing something that you really didn't deserve. Now can we talk, let's talk about it all over again and see what we can find. And that I think takes a bit of humbleness for parents to be able to try again when at first they, or when they succeeded at something that they decided maybe they didn't, shouldn't have. How we do it with young children age 3 without getting all uptight to help them, it's certainly patience and it's guidance and it's saying, let's do it together, or here is something. You know, if Dad spills a glass of milk at a table, Mom usually jumps to run for the cloth. If Tommy spills a glass of milk at the table, he usually gets a couple of labels and says, do you have to be so clumsy? Well, you go clean that up right now and do it this minute because it's going to ruin the table and all sorts of things. But if Aunt Tilly or a visitor or Dad does it, it's very different. I do it, I say, wow, I'm really clumsy, you know, I might label myself. Somebody else does it, that's nothing, nothing's going to happen, and so forth. How can we be consistent in this? Okay, spilled things need to be cleaned up, and when something happens we don't blame, we try to find solutions. The cloth is in the kitchen for Dad to get, or for Tommy to get. And maybe if it's a guest in our house, I'll go get it because I know where the cloth in the kitchen is and the guest may not. But that it's not a catastrophe in any case.
They don't have a hard time at all dealing with those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. No attitudes. You know, like my son was reaching for a toad and went, you know, soap. They all, you know, I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
As long as he didn't mean to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the thing I have to work out is, you know, if I would have seen him dive in, then I might have been madder.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as it was an accidental thing, you know, I don't have troubles with that. Sort of that fine line and
The whole idea of not expecting the child to have the same conscience and understanding that you as an adult, that another thing I was going to say before I forget it, is that our being as a person does not depend upon how well other people perceive our role as a parent. An illustration that was brought to me by a student who was 21 or 22 and was babysitting a weekend for 2 of her friend's children. And the children are fairly wild, and they were like age 4 and 6. And she took them into a grocery store. And she said, they started running down, they each took a cart, and they started running down the aisles and yelling and picking up this and that. And she said, I found myself yelling at them and saying, just wait until I tell your mother. Now, your mother would not allow, and she said, all of a sudden I heard myself, and I realized what I was doing was providing an excuse for myself that these were not my children, that I wasn't responsible for their actions, and I wanted everyone to know that they weren't my children. And what I needed to deal with was the children and say, look, if we cannot manage to get our groceries quietly, we'll just go out and wait until we can, because I do not feel this is appropriate behavior in a grocery store. And although my cupboard is empty and we don't have any food there for lunch, I guess we'll just have to wait until we can behave in a grocery store where we don't damage things and we don't bump into people and we don't yell and disturb people. And she said, they quieted down and they said, okay, what should we get? And she stopped and looked at them. They listened. They knew what they were doing. They thought they were going to be able to get whatever they wanted. And my yelling was exactly what their mother did, and it only gave them more fuel. So, because she ended up giving in. But when I put a threat into a choice, we can go out and wait, or we can do this properly, they were hungry enough that they decided that they could do it properly. And I didn't have to justify my being as being a good parent in front of everyone else in the store. I only had to deal with these 2 charges who were with me. And I hear a lot of people in grocery stores yelling at the top of their lungs and spanking their kids and saying, stop that or I'll spank you. Stop that crying or I'll spank you. And the spanking is just going to make them cry all the more. How can you control your feelings when you're hurt and you're embarrassed and you want something or whatever it is, and somebody's just telling you, stop it, and you're going to stop? Most adults can't control themselves that well, and you can't expect a youngster to do it.